No matter how old this is, bet you could go for one of these right now.
To all beef patty, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun.
That blast from the past sure sounds good, even if it's not good for you. But how bad are bad foods? We speak with Dr. Erin Carroll, author of the Bad Food Bible. Plus, comedy is the most recent industry to face stories of sexual harassment. Here's Patty Vasquez on WGN.
The fact is that that's happened to me consistently over the last 20 years of my career. And it's like anything else, hanging out with people, networking. Because if you're hanging out talking to comics, you know, you have an opportunity to, like, pitch them something.
We talked to women stand-up comics in Chicago, Patty Vasquez and Kristen Toomey. And we all know that homelessness can be devastating, even in cities with strong support systems. But the situation can be even more dire in Illinois' isolated rural areas. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As we head into the holiday season, I will tell you that one of my favorite things about the holidays, apart from spending time with people I love, is the food. Thanksgiving is my favorite food holiday, hands down. Christmas ranks second. And if anyone wants to invite me over to some Hanukkah dinner for Lukkos, I'm in. For many, this is also the time of year to freak out, though, about healthy eating even more than people normally do, especially if you're on the all-too-trendy paleo diet or whatever diet you're subscribing to these days, if you're trying to be low-carb or high-fat, or maybe you're a vegan or are going gluten-free. Whatever your choices are, it's exhausting trying to eat right, and often you're just left hungry. Dr. Erin Carroll knows all about this struggle and the science behind it. He's a frequent contributor to the New York Times and is the author of a new book called The Bad Food Bible, How and Why to Eat Sinfully. He joins me now from Indiana University, where he's a professor of pediatrics and the associate dean for research mentoring. Dr. Carroll, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. And there's a lot about food we're going to talk about, especially bad food. But for those who are listening, you're always welcome to join our conversation. You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21STShow. Dr. Carroll, I wanted to start by sharing a story with you, because as I was reading your book, I was thinking about this. I was diagnosed with breast cancer earlier this year. And before I started chemotherapy, when I was meeting with my oncology nutritionist, we talked about my diet, and then she said something that I feel like no doctor has ever said. She just said, so look, it sounds like you eat pretty healthy. Do not do anything strange to your diet during chemotherapy. She said, just be reasonable, eat whatever you want to eat, eat whatever feels good to you, and don't worry about anything else. And I feel like people were horrified that she said that to me, and they said she should have been giving you better medical advice. And I wonder for
what?
You, yeah, if
oh
that
my God.
Was.
Yeah, I was like, I was going to say you struck gold. That's like
that's the what best I was going to say to
I've
you.
Ever heard.
Right.
No, I mean,
but
I
that's
have, I
not what we hear from people.
Yeah. No. Yes. In fact, I have friends who were diagnosed with breast cancer and got the exact opposite message. It became immediately like, this is a list of things that you did wrong, which of course sent them into a shame spiral of like,
oh, well, people said that to me. No, don't get me wrong. Lots of people told me that, but my doctors never said that to me.
No, right. I've heard doctors, plenty of doctors and nutritionists say that too. And because doctors are human beings and they fall prey to the same kind of messages that everyone else does, as do nutritionists. And so many scientists, doctors, nutritionists, guideline writers have gotten this wrong again and again and again and again and again. But unfortunately, that's too often how we talk about food, is by scaring people, by moralizing, by making people afraid. And I'm thrilled that you got that message from your doctor, but that's, I will tell you, that's probably not normal.
Right. And that's what your book is about, right? Because
yeah.
Let's say someone is not does not have cancer or another illness that maybe people want to think about special eating, or you write a lot about pregnancy. I wonder what you think about the messages we have and how hard it is in society as just humans to deal with all of the different, and you write about this, the different research and studies and the completely conflicting messages we get all the time about what to eat.
Well, unfortunately, I think the conflicting messages are almost always telling you what not to eat. Nobody ever says, like, oh, yes, it's okay. But, you know, I would say that probably, you know, a theme of the book, and it's so many of the comments I write, is that whenever you're making any kind of health decision, period, you need to weigh both the benefits and the harms. You cannot just focus on one side. And unfortunately, I think when it comes to food, when it comes to messaging, we almost entirely always pick the harm side. It's fear-based. I mean, just last week, there was an article that got a lot of, I mean, an announcement that got articles all over the place that once again said alcohol causes cancer and sent everyone into a panic. But it only focused once again on the harm side, and the harms, while perhaps greater than zero for some people, are very, very, very small. And of course, there are also benefits to consider from any kind of dietary decision, and those include joy, those include cost. You know, you started by talking about how this time of year and the holidays that come up are your favorite food holidays. Why would someone try to take that away from you?
I feel like everyone's trying to take it away from us, aren't they?
Yeah, that makes no sense. I mean, you know, forever, eating and, you know, shared meals, these are times of joy and of family and of coming together. And we've turned, unfortunately, eating into this incredibly bad scientific process that has almost no humanity left to it, but it's just based in fear. And part of what I tried to do in the book is explain that the science behind that fear is almost never there, in which case you're just adding harm to your life for really no benefit. And that's just not a rational decision, and we should be thinking about food much differently.
I'm speaking with Dr. Alan Carroll. He's the author of The Bad Food Bible. He also teaches at Indiana University School of Medicine. I'm sorry, Dr. Aaron Carroll. Dr. Carroll, can I just ask you about the science behind everything? Because you talk about this in the book. Can you just give us a quick kind of rundown of when we see study, those of us who are not medical researchers think, okay, this is a gold standard of study, but you go through in your book all of the different ways that a lot of these are not necessarily randomized controlled trials.
Right. So there's sort of a hierarchy of studies, or of we should say scientific evidence, and sort of what you can believe in that knowing that something causes something else. Anytime you read a news story about some big breakthrough in medicine and it involves 8 genetically identical male mice, take it with a grain of salt. I mean, just, you know, the difference between all of the collected humanity and how we make decisions about nutrition and tiny animals in a lab are not the same. Then the next sort of level of study is just the anecdote, which is just, I heard something or somebody, oh, I have a friend who got a disease and they ate a lot of this and therefore, no, that has no science behind it. Neither do really case series, which are just collected anecdotes. Then you get into sort of case control studies, which are just, I got a bunch of people with cancer and a bunch of people that didn't together and tried to figure out a difference. Case control studies are how you hear things in the news like cell phones cause cancer, even though cancer rates are not through the roof and everyone uses a cell phone. Then there are sort of epidemiologic or cohort studies, which is what most food studies are, which are just basically big collected studies of people trying to find associations. And they're fine for associations, which are ideas about maybe something is associated with something else and we should look into it further. But the only kinds of studies that can tell us if something causes something else are what we call randomized controlled trials. Those are when we set up prospective trials and we get one group of people to do one thing and another group of people to do another thing. Ideally, they shouldn't even know what they're doing, the difference, and then we test what happens over time. Those are the only kinds of studies in general that can really prove causality. And they're rare in nutrition. And when we have them, too often we ignore them. And so, you know, even this is last week's news with cancer and alcohol. You know, we don't have any kind of randomized controlled trials with cancer, but we do have some randomized controlled trials of alcohol, and they've shown that they might reduce some chances of diabetes, and they might be actually protective with respect to some heart disease. So I'm not telling you to go out and drink, but I would say that we too often overemphasize studies which we shouldn't put too much stock in and ignore the studies that are much more powerful. And unfortunately, we do that in nutrition all of the time.
And there's so many studies about fat. Can I ask you about that? What does it matter what kind of fat we're eating? What do you think?
So, oh man, so it's like, this is where it's like, I would love to give you a definitive answer, but even still, the jury is out. I will say that not long ago, we used to be afraid of all fat equally. But first of all, trans fats, and made in a lab bad for you, but you almost can't find them anymore. But the case against unsaturated fat is almost gone. The idea that you need to fear unsaturated fat at all, try to limit it. I think even in the latest USDA guidelines, they finally come around and said, like, look, no one should be really limiting their unsaturated fat. With saturated fat, the jury is still out. You can find studies that show that if you can replace saturated fat with unsaturated fat, that might be a good thing. However, replacing saturated fat with carbs, not a good idea. And, you know, studies don't support that. So, you know, the diets that try to really, truly get you to limit all your fats do not have a lot of evidence behind them. In fact, you know, diets like the Mediterranean diet or diets which emphasize unsaturated fat appear to be very healthy and are some of the few that have randomized controlled data behind them. But, you know, in general, we are much more afraid of fat than we should be, and it's very likely that the sort of low-fat craze of the 60s and 70s and even the 80s pushed a lot of people into diets that were not good and might have contributed to the obesity epidemic in general.
So when it comes to foods, you're saying we can eat cheese, we can eat meat, they can be full fat?
Yeah, and well, it's like I wouldn't go crazy with it, you know, but in moderation, absolutely. The studies even with meat that show true danger. I mean, we're talking about studies where they're counting the number of servings of red meat people eat per day. Most people don't do that. So like, you know, don't. So yes, maybe don't eat multiple servings of processed red meat a day. But, you know, in general, there's nothing wrong with meat if it's part of a healthy diet. And even meat that has some saturated fat is likely fine as long as it's part of a well-balanced diet. And the only red meat that even sort of purists can point and say, well, we truly believe that this causes cancer, is processed red meat, and it's a relative risk. So this is one of the examples that I often use, where if I, Aaron Carroll, committed to eating an extra serving of 3 pieces of bacon every day for the rest of my life, my overall risk of cancer, you know, lifetime risk of cancer might go up by something like half a percentage point overall. I'm not going to eat that much bacon. I'm not going to do that. And that's not that big a risk overall if I chose to do it. So likely you're not going to get that much of a risk. It's not going to make that much of a difference in your life, and you're not going to eat that much in general. So trying to always pitch it in these very scary messages about your relative risk of getting a bad disease, they just don't hold water, and they're much scarier than they are in reality.
And I think you mentioned sort of the obsession in the 70s and the 80s with fat. I think what everyone talks about now is gluten and being gluten-free. Do you think people should be avoiding gluten?
Well, look, if you're part of the less than 1% of the population that has celiac disease, absolutely, you have to.
And if less than 1% of the population, I should you
yes,
said.
Yes, exactly. We're talking less than 1% of the population has celiac disease. Even fewer people in the United States have a true wheat allergy, and they may want to avoid, you know, they have to avoid wheat in general, so avoiding gluten might be good for them. But the other 20%+ of us that aren't in those two categories and yet are purchasing gluten-free food all the time are not getting really any benefit. There is no scary thing about gluten. It's been part of our diet forever. You know, wheat still in the rest of the world is pretty much, with the exception perhaps of rice, but they're pretty close. You know, 20% of the world's calories come from wheat worldwide, and people are not suffering because they're being exposed to gluten. They're not. It's just this is a United States thing, and it's often, again, a fear thing where we've sort of latched on to what's the panic du jour. Many people are focusing on gluten, but the vast, vast, vast majority of people who are, you know, trying to find a gluten-free diet aren't there. People will claim that they are sometimes gluten intolerant, which is a vague set of symptoms. In studies, the people that claim they're gluten intolerant rarely meet the criteria, and even when they do, they don't see benefit in good studies from going on a gluten-free diet. So we can't find evidence for this. And yet again, as I said before, something like 20%+ of Americans are still searching out gluten-free food, which often has less nutrients, often has more calories, certainly costs more. You're not getting much of a benefit. You're living in fear once again, and it's really not doing much good. We spend a couple $1 billion on gluten-free dog food each year. And again, this is how far we go, is we're now searching for phantom problems in our pets, as well as just within ourselves. There's no reason to be this afraid of a food that has been with us since like the dawn of man. You know,
what do you say to people? We just have a minute or two left, but I wonder what you say to people. I have friends who insist that removing gluten from their diet has made them so healthy and it's made them better people and that they've lost weight and that they're no longer sick because they're not eating gluten. What do you say to people when they tell you that?
One, I don't ever try to change people's behavior if they're happy doing what they're doing. Fine. Like, if it works for you, I'm thrilled. I have a problem when they try to tell me or other people what to do. What most of them are seeing is the opposite of the placebo effect. It's called the nocebo effect. So it's well documented that people will, if they believe something is going to work, it is more likely to work. That's the placebo effect. The nocebo effect is the exact same thing in the opposite. If they believe something is harmful, they get a harm. And if they eliminate it, they sometimes feel a benefit. So if people believe strongly enough that gluten is doing them harm, then sometimes when they give it up, they see an improvement. That's fine again, but of course it wanes over time because it's not real. It's partly imagined. The other thing is that sometimes, by going on a gluten-free diet, people improve their diet in general. They reduce the number of processed foods they're eating. They reduce perhaps their intake of refined carbohydrates. They start to eat more, you know, a well-balanced diet of protein and fruits and vegetables. So be it. Like, I'm all for that. I have no problem if people want to eat healthier diets in general and see a benefit, but they shouldn't be telling other people they're doing it wrong or living in fear. You can eat a better diet, a more healthy diet, without 100% eliminating gluten from your diet. You could just reduce it, perhaps, or reduce your intake of processed foods, which are often linked with gluten.
Dr. Carroll, we just have about 30 seconds left. Can you give us a rule of thumb as we think about holiday eating? I know you're going to give us a life rule in general, but how should we be thinking about food?
So again, you know, it's one, two, three days a year. Enjoy yourself. That's my first message. Just you know, in general, try to eat pretty healthily. But on Thanksgiving, all bets go out the window. I'm having extra pie. I'm just going to. Like, it's a holiday. I'm allowed. And there's no proven lifetime benefit of trying to, you know, make myself scared and live like, you know, ascetic on that one day a year. So, you know, make sustained changes over time. That's how you fix your diet for a lifetime. Don't worry about the one day.
That's Dr. Aaron Carroll. He's the author of The Bad Food Bible, How and Why to Eat Sinfully. He also teaches at Indiana University School of Medicine, where he joined us from. Thanks for being with me, Dr. Carroll.
Thank you.
Tuning into the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Whether you live in Chicago, Champaign, or Carbondale, chances are you've encountered someone who's homeless. And the causes of homelessness in those places are often the same when we think about mental illness, domestic violence, acute poverty, just to name a few of the many causes. But when you leave cities, it becomes even more difficult to survive without a home. In rural areas, social services are more limited, transportation is more restrictive, and the jobs are more scarce. According to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, there were more than 13,000 people living without homes in Illinois as of January. But just as those numbers are probably not entirely accurate and hard to pin down, it's even more difficult to say how many people in Illinois who are homeless in the state's more isolated or rural areas. On the line now from his Carbondale newsroom to help us better understand what homelessness looks like in rural communities is Isaac Smith, a reporter for the Southern Illinois. Rob Dahlhaus is also with us from our Urbana studio, where he's the executive director for the homeless advocacy group CU at Home in Champaign. Rob, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Isaac, I should say Southern Illinoisan. Sorry, why did I say this? Well, it's good to have you back as well, Isaac.
Thank you so much.
Isaac, you had a story in your paper. It was yours that you wrote. It featured a man named Leonard Wilmore and his dog, Lucky. Can you first tell me how and where you met Leonard?
Sure. Well, I was actually driving back from an assignment in Benton that day. I was driving back to my house, and I noticed actually smoke coming from underneath a bridge, and, you know, the thought crossed my mind, I should probably stop. Either this is a fire that should be reported, or this is someone living under here, and I should probably just, you know, be a human and make sure that they're okay. And that's how I met Leonard. You know, I stopped and said, hey, are you doing okay? And he was actually at first very concerned, you know, that I was going to ask him to leave. And when he realized that I wasn't going to do that, you know, he just kind of opened up to me. And, you know, we spent a couple of afternoons talking and actually gathering firewood together.
What was Leonard's story? Can you tell us a little bit about how he ended up living under a bridge?
Sure. So Leonard, and, you know, with all people, I'm sure there might be more to his story than even I understand. But when I asked him, he said several months ago, back in the summer, he had was experiencing health problems. I think he had a heart condition that prevented him from going to work. He was working as a cleaner for a large company, and they let him go. But he told me prior to that he actually had been without a house before being let go, but obviously not having a job any longer sort of put the nail in the coffin for him being able to get back into having shelter. I mean, that's the long and short of it. I think he had been under that bridge. He'd been out of the house several weeks when I met him, and then only under that bridge for maybe a week or two. A week or two.
And what was his everyday life living like? You said you spent a lot of time helping him gather firewood?
Yeah, I spent a little bit of time gathering some wood. I think there's some images on our website of that. But when I asked him, I said, what do you do with your days? Because he had a full campsite set up down there with a little bit of food and a tent. And, you know, he had a dog and a cat, actually, that ended up finding him, and he adopted the cat, too. He would try and, I think, walk a couple of miles into town and just try and get a couple of dollars together. He told me he was still looking for work, but not really knowing where to go, and having transportation really made that difficult for him. So he just spent every day trying to make it to the next, I think.
That's Isaac Smith. He's a reporter for the Southern Illinois. And as he mentioned, a story he did about rural homelessness sparked this conversation we're having on the 21st today. We have tweeted out, if you follow our handle 21ST show, Isaac's story. You can see those pictures that he mentioned. Rob Dahlhaus is in our Urbana studios, where he's director of See You at Home. Rob, can I just ask you, as we think about Leonard, one story of many, as Isaac said, there's lots of different reasons and nuances to all of these stories, but I wanted to just focus on one thing about Leonard sort of moving in and out of having a home. How common is that, just when we talk about people who end up homeless in general?
Yeah. It's great to be here, and I think it's very common. You know, we see a lot of the folks that we work with that that kind of, you know, move from place to place, couch surf, and are just always, they're on the verge. You know, they're on the verge of being ending up on the street, which is a really, really sad reality. You know, I think for those folks, it's difficult to find the resources that they need. It's difficult to kind of know where to go, especially as social services kind of change and morph due to, you know, wherever the funding is at for that time. But it's very difficult for them to kind of maintain that stable housing, and it's very common for us to see those folks trying to, you know, moving from one program to another, or trying to find, you know, where am I going to stay tonight? Where am I going to stay this week? And when that is the main thought in your mind, it becomes very difficult to have any kind of other future-oriented thoughts, because you're literally, how am I going to survive one night to the next?
Yeah, I can't imagine how tough that is. Rob, can I ask how much more tough this is in a rural setting versus a city? You mentioned funding, and I want to get to all of that in a minute, just sort of your agency and funding. But part of this is also jobs, and for people who, obviously, money is a key component of this as well. Mm-hmm. What other challenges are there for you when you're in a rural area and you are homeless?
Yeah, I mean, it does depend on the services that are available. But, you know, if you're in a smaller town, if you're in a a more, you know, wooded area, or there's not, you know, a big city close by, it can be very difficult for you to get the services that you need. Transportation can be a big barrier. You know, if there's not mental health or substance abuse services in the areas that you're in, trying to get to those places can be very, very difficult. And then, as we've seen a lot, you know, folks will move through our rural areas trying to get to a bigger city where there's more resources. And sometimes they just end up stuck here, and they may have a hotel for a night or two, or they may have a friend that they think they could stay with or thought they could stay with, and then that ends up falling through, and then all of a sudden you're at the bottom, and trying to, like you said, you know, get a few dollars together to try to find that place to stay, and it's just really difficult. It's difficult for those folks to find that stable housing, those stable resources.
And right, and transportation is a part of this. Isaac, you mentioned how much of a challenge this was for Leonard, walking at least 2 miles to the nearest town to try to find work or supplies. What did you find in your reporting, Isaac, about particularly transportation in rural areas and how that would work?
Well, that's like an incredibly complicated and incredibly simple topic, really, because for Leonard, he didn't have a car. He relied, I think, on his brother to come and help him maybe if he had to move from site A to site B. His brother might help him do that. And I would like to note that Leonard, as a result of that story, actually did get shelter. Someone did come and find him and help him out. But in my area, to be honest, the budget impasse really affected transportation. Some places had to limit greatly where they could take people. One example I was given by a homeless advocate in the area was saying that, you know, Carbondale and Marion are maybe 15 minutes apart. And so if you were homeless in Carbondale but managed your job in Marion.
Yeah.
Yeah, by car, that which is an all-day walk, really. So if you were lucky enough to get a job in Marion but were homeless living in Carbondale trying to, you know, get a better footing, you can always rely on public transportation because public transportation, a lot of it stops at the county line. So getting from a very rural place to a population center where there's a job may be really challenging. That's the one thing that I could see maybe a place like Chicago being modestly easier, and that is not at all to minimize the struggles those people have, but being able to take a train from the south end to the north end or east to west that's reliable, I think, is probably a great asset.
Right. And in fact, it's interesting that you bring that up, Isaac, because I know lots of folks who work with different members of the homeless population here or people who are on the verge of that talk about how often, you know, most of the jobs, though, happen to be in the suburbs and there isn't as much public transportation there. Rob, I wonder what this looks like in a place like Champaign County. Groups like yours, See You at Home, work with people on trying to solve transportation issues. How does that work in Champaign?
Well, sure, I can speak for kind of how our ministry does it. We have a great public transportation system here in town that gets people all over the place and kind of helps bridge that gap. We do have a transportation part in our ministry as well that we can actually take folks to treatment facilities, to shelters, to a place where the services are if we're not able to provide them in Champaign. And I have to give Isaac props because I think he did the hardest thing. It is just reaching out and making that connection and, you know, treating that person as an individual. That's a huge step to getting someone to build trust with you, to build a relationship and to then see success. That's kind of what our ministry is founded on, just building those relationships. So I really appreciate that story and his ability to do that. That's fantastic.
Yeah, Robert, thanks for that, and thanks for pointing that out to Isaac. And I wanted to ask you also, just on that note, I think there's sort of two ends of this, right? Because there's the folks who need help and then the folks who are offering help. And I wanted to ask you about whether or not you find it a struggle for people to be able to accept help, because there's obviously a lot of pride involved with what some people might see as handouts or charity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good question, first of all. And, you know, the way we look at it is the idea of what is empowering and what is enabling. You know, when you have a relationship with someone, you need to make sure that it's two-way, that there's give and take. You know, that there, for us, we don't want a relationship to end up being that there's always a giver and always a taker. If you work with somebody and develop the trust with them and develop that relationship where they feel comfortable, you know, being involved in a two-way relationship like that, you're going to see a lot more success when somebody is always the recipient of something and you are always the provider. There is a these lines drawn, and there's this stigma created that you as the provider are above this person, and it really can affect someone's dignity. It can really affect their self-esteem, their self-confidence, and it's not meant to be that. You know, we don't think of it that way. We want to just help this person, but when you really dig down deep, you know, there's books out there. Toxic Charity is one that that was really an eye opener for me. And also, When Helping Hurts, we just need it was another book. We just need to make sure that you know what we're doing for these folks is empowering them and helping them move in a more positive direction. And I think that's just a tiny nuance to look at. And Isaac's example is really good of helping this person, you know, really succeed.
Right. That's Rob Dahlhouse. He's the director of CU at Home. Rob Dahlhouse III, I should add. Isaac Smith is with us as well from Carbondale. Isaac, in your reporting, and you just mentioned this, you talked about the budget impasse, and we've talked about the effect that's had, in particularly in rural populations, on transportation and jobs. I wonder how much of this also comes back to lack of resources, and especially in areas like healthcare and mental health.
I would say that's a very, very big component of this. I mean, homelessness, and actually I should probably clarify, I think housing insecure is like a lot better of a term, because homelessness elicits this picture of, you know, the man asking for money on the street. Housing insecure, I think, takes all of the nuance in the issue and puts it into a phrase. But I would say that is a very big component. And in my research, you know, I talked to homelessness advocates or homeless advocates, and they said that it can take maybe a decade to repair the damage by dwindling funding and stopped funding for some of these social services as a result of that budget impasse in Springfield for, what was it, almost 3 years. So I, to answer your question briefly, I think that is a very big component.
Right. And as we think about this also, I wanted to just ask you one quick question, Isaac. You, in your reporting, advocates told you something that seems very unsettling, that some areas were actually, quote, shipping homeless people to places like Carbondale. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and I should say I didn't talk to anyone specifically who had that happen to them. It was more these advocates who received these people, and they would talk to people getting off of buses or people that you know they'd found on the street and were trying to offer services to, and they would say, yeah, I was in place X, and they didn't really know what to do. They didn't have a shelter for me where I was at, and so they got me a bus ticket and said, get off in Carbondale. And thinking that Carbondale, I guess, was like some sort of mecca or a place that would have services for these folks. And there are services, but what they told me was, if we didn't experience that, this influx of people coming from the outside, if other communities were able to better support their transient populations like that, Carbondale would have a much easier time helping the population that it has, if you want to consider it, natively. So it is kind of a problem. I mean, rural 16 counties south of 64 is not a densely populated place. Population centers are few and far between. So on the one hand, it makes sense, and on the other hand, it kind of makes a whole other problem.
Right. We're just about out of time. Isaac, quickly wanted to ask you, going back to the story of Leonard Wilmore, you said he has found housing at the moment?
Yeah, I actually received an email the weekend the story ran. Leonard used to be a resident of Cesar, and some of his former classmates actually realized, oh my gosh, I know this person, so they went and found him. I was very careful not to say where he was, but they figured it out and collected him and his things and helped him find shelter for the winter. And so, yeah, he has found help. But what I had another phone call asking about him, and what I've asked people to do is focus on the forest, not the trees, and recognize that I had to find a face for this story, and his story is very important, but there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people in this area that need the same help. So maybe try and seek out other ways to lend a hand.
That's Isaac Smith with the Southern Illinoisan. Thanks so much for your reporting. Thanks to Rob Dahlhaus for being with us as well at CEU at Home. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you so much.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last Thursday, five women accused Louis C.K. of sexual misconduct in a piece published by the New York Times. These women were working in comedy when he exposed himself and engaged in sexual misconduct on several occasions. He's responded to the statement saying, quote, these stories are true. Since then, the premiere of his film has been canceled. HBO has pulled his projects from their streaming service. And over the past few weeks, it joins just another industry in which we have been talking about sexual harassment, whether it's politics, food and drinks, journalism. Today, we wanted to focus on comedy, especially right here in Chicago, which is known nationally for its comedy scene. Joining me in our Chicago studios are two writers, producers, and stand-up comics, Kristen Toomey and Patty Vasquez. Kristen, I don't know why I'm calling you Christian. Kristen and Patty, welcome to the 21st. And Patty, you've got your own radio program as well in WGN. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us. Yeah,
Patty, were you not surprised?
No.
By the New York Times.
How did you know I wasn't surprised? No, I was relieved. You mentioned that five women came forward last Thursday. They've actually been coming forward with the story since it happened in 2002.
So that's in the comedy scene.
But they came to they reported to their managers. They reported to his manager, and comics have known about it.
Yeah.
And some people sort of knew about it. It was in social media, so it wasn't
Brandon
just.
Brandon Gawker was writing about this. I think as early as 2012. Right. So
and
this...
Jen Kirkman came out.
Yeah.
And everybody knew. I think. I find it interesting that, you know, it came to this following him insulting Trump and doing all that. It's like, well, now we're going to believe the women that have been saying this for 15 years.
Exactly.
It's kind of weird.
And I wonder, like, how many people working on his film were like, your film's hitting a little close to home.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard anything about I Love You, Daddy. But
I have a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you guys, and Patty, let me start with you. You said people, and again, this is one of those things where people in the industry have known about this. Is this something where other women warned you about him?
Did
you warn other women?
I just shared a story with Kristen on a personal level. I worked with opened for Louis in 1999 and didn't see him again until his career took off, and tried talking to him at a festival, and he could not have been a more horrible person. And then
just in general,
I tried congratulating him and reintroduced myself. I wasn't going to assume he remembered
me. Hi, I'm Patty Vasquez.
Yeah, and I was like, I want to say congratulations. Your career's really taken off. He goes, no. And walked, basically body checked me to get around me. And then I worked with him the following summer. I was hired to be his opening act while he was working on his HBO special. And then again, he was a vile person. I've never been so miserable in a green room in my career. And I stood my ground. I stayed in the green room because that was my space too. Because
good girl.
I wasn't going to be driven out of there because he was being a jerk.
And I think that's the hard thing, though. And Kristen, so much of working in comedy is being on the road and networking with people, pitching them your ideas.
Yeah.
Does it make it really difficult then to avoid sexual harassment, especially if it's someone who's in a position of power, and how much that matters in comedy?
I don't know if it's difficult to avoid it. I think it becomes a challenge to overcome situations like that and learn, you know, red flags about, like, okay, that doesn't line up. That doesn't seem legit. That seems kind of shady. I'm not going to take that gig, or I don't like, you know, I've had a lot of handsy bookers before, and I just am straight up and I just say, you know, don't touch me. And it's a lot of
and
setting
does that
your
work?
Own. Yeah.
Yeah.
For me, it works so far, you know, but I mean, it's not guaranteed to work, but you know, you do have to put some thought into, okay, I'm going on the road by myself. Who's on the show? Do I know these comics? You know, do I know this booker? Do I have friends that have worked there and it's all right? You know, things like that. But,
And Kristen, I didn't realize this when we were talking. I was talking with the producers and they were talking to you guys ahead of this segment, that oftentimes when you are asked to perform at another club and you're on the road, they'll put you up, but you may end up being sharing mm-hmm. like an apartment or something with people you've never met before.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty common thing.
Yeah. And yeah, sometimes it's men, you know.
I've never shared a condo with a woman except for Diana Lima, who took me on the road to open for her, because they rarely ever put two women on one show.
Yeah.
I know that you travel.
Oh, that's right. The other thing, because you're the woman also. Yeah. That's the other thing. So there's
the
only,
woman.
Right.
Yeah.
So then there only ends up being one.
The lovely lady, the very beautiful, the cute, the adorable. It's never like the very, you know, the talented or the very funny. It's
right.
But yeah,
charming.
I've had to share a lot of that's one of the great things, is when you have the ability to say, I'm not going to do this gig because I just can't be in another comedy condo. They're just, I mean, it's just
horrible. It's gross.
I get knocks on my door. When I was younger, they would knock on the door and be like, come on.
What
no
do you
one
mean a comedy condo?
That's the apartment. They would put us together.
That's what they're called.
Comedy condos, yeah.
Okay.
So in order to save money, and rather than putting comics up in hotel rooms, they rent an apartment for a really cheap price. And they give each comic a room. Some places it's only a couch. Or in Appleton, there's a doorless room for the MC.
Yeah, who is a woman sometimes.
Yeah.
And two men are in there with no door on her room. But, you know, I mean, I don't think that, you know, it's given, women are given that much consideration as like how that would make them feel to be in that situation, you know, staying in a condo with
two strange
men. So you're
saying, Kristen, you're saying women are not given that consideration at all?
At all, no. We're supposed to be lucky to be there.
Yeah.
Right? We're lucky to get on that couch, man, because we're fighting every other female in the country to sleep on that nasty couch, mm-hmm. you know?
And how does this work, Patty? Let's start with you. Right, because so much of this is about networking and your career and who you know and your reputation and people liking you.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, yeah.
So, Patty, let me start with you. How does that play into when, you know, forget like Louis C.K. being a jerk, when it's a situation where it's actual sexual harassment or misconduct or something even worse.
Right. And the thing is that women that want to have access to that upward mobility, right, the path to success with someone like Louis who's that successful, then do you know these rumors? This is what Jen Kirkman went through. She was invited to be his opening act and she knew what risk she might be taking. And the women he did that to, he didn't help their career. I mean, like that's
right.
He didn't even help their career.
He didn't even
hurt their careers.
And not that it hurt their careers.
Because his manager went after them, and you know, it's like the thing of. I'm sorry to cut you off.
Yeah,
but
no,
I just feel like Louis is one of those comics where can get away with so much because he's so well respected by other comedians, and so they sort of protect him. And I've been guilty of it, too. It's like I heard the rumor, but like I was, you know, he was like a hero of mine. And I was just like, I can't imagine him being like that. And I don't want to think about that. I want to enjoy his comedy, you know. And then it's like I'm talking to Patty out in the lobby and she's telling me how he's just like no in her face. And I was like, you know what? Forget it. Like, he's a jerk. Like, but the fact that it took that on top of the sexual assault for me to finally be like, write him off completely is ridiculous. You know, that's how I think with women, we're just so compassionate and willing to, you know, forgive,
excuse
mm-hmm. and rationalize, justify. And I think we're pretty well trained sometimes.
And I think everybody for celebrities is to give them the benefit of the doubt, you know, which is fine, I guess.
That's Patty Vasquez. I'm also speaking with Kristen Toomey. They're both stand-up comics here in Chicago. And let me ask you something, Kristen. You said about his comedy, because now I think there's a really interesting question as all of these things come out. Can he be funny anymore? Can we enjoy his past things? I was just thinking about, oh, man, like he was like the lovable boyfriend in Parks and Rec. And now I know all this stuff about him. Oh, I don't know if they can watch this or enjoy this. And how, you know, do you think about that?
I think about that all the time. And actually, I mean, I'm fired up right now because of what Patty said. But overall,
sorry.
overall, that's a very valid, very good question. Thank you for asking. I feel like so much of every person, the three of us right here, if the world knew the worst thing we've ever done, you know, they wouldn't approve probably. And so I feel like everyone is capable and does do terrible things. And that shouldn't take away from the art that we've contributed to the world, you know, because I think art is very important. Now, is he still a good comedian? Of course, he still has that muscle. He still is a genius in my mind. But is his career definitely needs to sit down right now? Yeah, he needs to, you know.
Do you think his career should be over?
No, I don't. I don't think his career should be over. I think he should, you know, take some time and reflect. But I feel like, no.
Patty, what do you think?
As far as his career being over, I would imagine that somewhere in the next few years, somebody in his sort of cabal, like whether it's Chris Rock or somebody of that stature, puts him in a movie or a project. Because Chris Rock was really one of the ways he exploded, too, is he was a writer for the Chris Rock Show. That's not, you know, destroying somebody's career isn't anywhere near what I'm, you know, in my purview. You know,
I'm not talking about destroying his career, but I'm wondering if you think
his career deserves
to be over. And it's an interesting point that Kristen has made, that his art still stands regardless of his character and what he has done. And I wonder if you agree with that.
Well, look, for me, I stopped liking him when he was horrible to me in person, right? So that doesn't have anything to do with what he was good at. I would watch him trying to understand what it was that made everybody else like him so much, you know, knowing how kind of despicable and gross he was. So he's almost more philosophical sometimes than funny, right? And he's always trying to generate, and it's, I don't know that, I mean, he was always shocking even in the 90s. I mean, he would do this material about what is way gay and then go into the graphic detail about that. So there was always something he was pushing forward, trying to like make people talk about things and think about things. So, you know, whether or not he deserves to have his career over, again, that's up to everybody else.
And you, last night, you host a show on WGN. Last Friday, you had listeners call in to talk about all of this.
Yeah.
What was that like?
You know, it's funny, not only that, but today it happened again on another show I was listening to this morning. Men were calling and saying, well, if women didn't dress like that, or don't you like it when a guy tells you how good your hoo-has look or what? I don't even know. It was a weird word he used because I was like, I don't even think you're using that appropriately. But I was surprised at how many, I think men are taking this personally, and rather than saying and listening to a woman tell you her story about what is going on, what is fundamentally going on and going wrong, they're hearing, I didn't do that. I'm not doing that.
Right.
And that's not what we're telling you. We're just asking you to listen.
Well, okay. Last question. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say I feel like men do feel like they're being attacked right now, and they're so quick to be defensive instead of, I feel like with the whole world right now, we're all just sort of purging this negative, you know, just.
And there's a lot.
It's like a big zit. It's like a big zit, America. The world is a zit that is ready to be popped, and it's popping. And, you know, it's gross right now, but we're going to clean it up and put a little Neosporin on it.
Maybe a little ice.
Here's my question, Kristen. Kristen, what I love the analogy of America right now is only a stand-up comedian could be, Kristen Toomey.
Thank you.
Patty Vasquez is also with us. Both of you, last question for you. Do you see any changes in Chicago's comedy scene, whether it's improv or stand-up? Because of all of
this. It's going to take audiences, I think, to make the difference because we've been here. We've been showing up. We've been doing the work.
What do you want audiences to do then?
To demand more out of their clubs, because a lot of people will tell a comedy club booker or manager that they don't like female comics, and all you need is that one person for an owner to go, there goes a drink I'm not going to sell. But the people who do like female comics, I mean, just like anything else, you always hear
it. There needs to be more women comedians, and that will help.
No, more audiences that show up and demand.
More female comedians.
Yeah.
And yeah, I agree. I think that is really, I think that, you know, like I said, this is all being purged for a reason. And then when it all settles, you know, the cream of the crop will rise at the top. And it's women in Chicago, in my opinion.
Yeah. We've been here. We've been strong and
loud.
We've
been here. We're not going anywhere.
No.
Everybody else needs to catch up.
Yep. That's right. Exactly. That we don't mean that like in a threatening way.
I do.
Please call your comedy club.
I'm threatening
say,
you.
Really love to hear a female voice.
Louie's not the predator. I am.
Oh, no.
Come to my show.
Oh,
I'm kidding.
She's kidding. That's Kristen Toomey. I want to thank Patty Vasquez as well. Both of them in the stand-up world. Patty's got a show on WGN as well. Kristen, you're a writer. Also, thank you both for being
you.
Ladies.
Thank you
for being with me for this. For us today, you can always find past shows on the NPR One app if you search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to enable The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media. It's all at our website, 21stshow.org. By the way, our Twitter handle, 21stshow. If you follow us, we live tweet during the program with more analysis, background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We're produced by Robin Lynn, Alan Montesilio, and Bob Holly. Grace Stetson and Libby Foster are interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help, and special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, broadcasting today from the Medill Graduate School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.